Welcome to my commentary on Paul's letter to the disciples in the province of Galatia, otherwise known as the Book of Galatians. Okay, we're up to Galatians chapter 3, verse 15. We'll do through verse 18. And this is one hard passage to understand. Hopefully I can explain it simply. This is very controversial. Those who believe in replacement theology, meaning the church has replaced Israel, and Israel has no more prophetic and historic importance in the eyes of God, this passage is very important to them. It's one of their proof texts. Of course, I do not believe in replacement theology. I need to remind us of a couple things here. The comparison between the Mosaic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant, because Paul speaks of both of them in this passage. The Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. The Mosaic covenant is conditional. That means the Abrahamic covenant God will fulfill no matter what. The Mosaic covenant is only fulfilled when and if Israel obeys the covenant. The Abrahamic covenant was not made between God and Abraham. The Mosaic covenant was made between God and Israel. The Abrahamic covenant, God promised himself to do certain things, whether the recipients of the covenant did anything or not. It was unconditional. The Mosaic covenant was conditional because both God and Abraham entered, I should say God and Israel, entered into covenant. And they both understood the covenant and they both agreed to keep their part of the covenant. Although Israel, over the years, has continually failed to live up to their portion of the covenant. Thus, they are under and have been under the curse of the covenant. They are now beginning to get removed from that curse. I'll talk more about that later. Verse 15 begins with the word brothers. Paul still believes these Galatian believers are brothers. They have not fully given themselves to the false teaching of the false teachers. They are leaning towards accepting the false teachers, but they're not there yet. Therefore, Paul still believes they are true Christians. Verse 15 says, "Brothers, let me take an example from everyday life. Just as no one can set aside or add to a human covenant that has been duly established, so it is in this case." The human covenant that has been duly established that Paul is talking about is a will. It's a last will and testament. That is what the Greek portrays in this verse. Paul is using a human contract, which is a will, to explain what he's going to say. Verse 16 says, "The promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed." Very important words here. The word promises is important because it's speaking of the Abrahamic covenant. How do I know this phrase, this verse 16, is about the Abrahamic covenant? Because he says so. He says the promises were spoken to Abraham and his seed. The word Abraham and seed is in reference to the Abrahamic covenant. When it comes to the word promises in verse 16, that's important because there was more than one promise in the Abrahamic covenant. There was a promise of Abraham having a son. There was a promise of land being given to his descendants, to a nationhood given to his descendants. God promised Abraham that Israel would be a great nation. There were many promises. Another promise was that Israelis would number as many as the stars of the sky. So we need to know the Abrahamic covenant consists of more than one promise. The word spoken is important because God spoke the promises to Abraham. He did not make a covenant with Abraham. He only spoke the covenant. God made the covenant with himself. He swore by himself that he would promise certain things, and these things would be forever. He would not ever negate the promises that he spoke. Now, Genesis 15 shows us the confirmation of this covenant that God agreed with himself and spoke to Abraham. As was the tradition among the Jews and amongst pretty well all civilizations in Abraham's day, there was normally a confirmation ceremony. If two people agreed on something, like a covenant, a contract, a deal, there was some kind of confirmation ceremony. The confirmation ceremony that we see in Genesis 15 consists of the following. God told Abraham to kill an animal, to cut the pieces up, and lay the pieces out on the ground. That was the normal routine amongst the Jews to confirm a covenant. If you and I were making a covenant back in Abraham's day, after the pieces of animal were placed on the ground, we would walk through these pieces. We would verbally speak the terms of the covenant, which would include blessings and curses. If we kept the covenant, we would be blessed with certain things. If we broke the covenant, we would be cursed with certain things. That's how it worked in Abraham's day. Now, in Genesis 15, to prove that God did not make a covenant with Abraham, God put Abraham to sleep. Abraham did not participate in the covenant-confirming ceremony. God alone, God himself, walked through the pieces of that dead animal. He himself spoke the covenant terms. Abraham had nothing to do with it. He was asleep. That proves that God did not make the covenant with Abraham. He made it with himself. This was an everlasting covenant. Nothing would change. God promised certain things, and he will fulfill his promise. Nothing will change that. That's very strong in Paul's thinking. Now we see, according to verse 16, that the promise or promises were made or spoken to, I should say, to people, to Abraham and to his seed. So let's carry on to see what Paul means by the word seed. Verse 16 continues, the scripture does not say, and to seeds, meaning many people, but, and to your seed, meaning one person. And then Paul says that one person is Christ Jesus. Paul is making a big deal over one letter, and that's the letter S. He says the Abrahamic covenant is spoken to Abraham and to his seed, who Paul says is Jesus. Because if seed is singular, obviously it can't be referring to a whole bunch of people, which would be Israel. Now, you might want to know how Paul understands this word seed. In the Hebrew text, in the Genesis account, the Hebrew word that is translated as seed in the King James Version and offspring in the NIV and other English translations is the Hebrew word zera. Zera simply means sowing or to sow. So if somebody was planting a garden, he was sowing seed. Whether he sowed one seed or 100 seeds, the word zera would be used. If a man impregnated his wife, the word zera would be used in reference to his seed, the semen. When God spoke the Abrahamic covenant to Abraham, he also spoke it to his seed. Seed in Hebrew, zera, is a singular word. It is never used in the plural. Therefore, the King James Version always translates it as seed. Now, the NIV translates zera in two ways. It translates it as offspring, which means seed, but it also translates it as descendants, plural, with an S on it. So to recap, King James translates zera as seed, NIV translates zera as offspring and descendants. So if you read the King James, you will see there are two recipients of the Abrahamic covenant, Abraham and the seed. If you read the NIV, you will see there are three recipients of the Abrahamic covenant, Abraham, the offspring, and the descendants of Abraham. Now, you're going to ask, why do we have the difference between the KJV and the NIV? Well, the NIV translators translate zera as descendants in certain parts of the Genesis account because they feel the promises spoken to zera could only be fulfilled in more than one person, meaning Abraham's descendants, Israel. So the context determines how zera is translated. The King James translators avoided this difficulty by just translating it as seed, singular, all the way through. So who does Paul agree with, the King James or the NIV? Obviously, he doesn't agree with either. This is what's happening here. I believe there are three recipients of the Abrahamic covenant. There is Abraham, there is his seed, Jesus, and his descendants, Israel. In this passage, Paul only speaks of the two, Abraham and Jesus, because of the nature of what he is saying. He is talking about one thing in this passage, and that is finding justification and righteousness by relying totally on Jesus. He is not speaking about Israel's place in prophetic history. He does that in Romans 9 through 11. If he had commented on that here, he surely would have confused us all. This is confusing as it is. Verse 17. What I mean is this. The law, introduced 430 years later, does not set aside the covenant previously established by God and thus do away with the promise. Now we have 430 years here. That's a debatable issue amongst theologians. The Genesis account says 400. Paul says 430. The obvious thing that's going on here is Paul is dating this event differently than the Genesis account. He's either starting it a little earlier or ending it a little earlier. And I won't get into that here because the main issue of verse 17 is that the law that came 400 plus years later cannot nullify or lay aside the promises of the Abrahamic covenant. It's impossible. And we will see his reasoning. Verse 18 says, for if the inheritance, see the word inheritance here, that proves that we're talking about an inheritance, because back in verse 15, remember the human contract, I said that was an inheritance in the Greek, and so we have that here. The Abrahamic covenant is a will, it's an inheritance. Verse 18 says, but if the inheritance depended on the law, then it no longer depends on promise. See, God promised himself to bless Abraham. This was a promise, and as the text states throughout Genesis, it's an everlasting promise. If the law of Moses, that was a conditional law that had to be obeyed, if the promises stated in the Abrahamic covenant depended on obeying the law of Moses, that would mean what God said in the Abrahamic covenant wasn't a promise. It wasn't a promise. It was something that had to come about by Israel doing something. But when God promises something, when he promises to do something, he won't break his promise. He won't change his mind. A promise is a promise. The simple fact is, to get the promise by obeying a law nullifies the promise, and there's no logic in that. Hopefully you understand that point. So I'll read verse 18 again. For if the inheritance depends on law, then it no longer depends on promise. But God in his grace, his unmerited favor, God in his grace gave it to Abraham through promise. God chose Abraham because he wanted to. His sovereign will, he just chose Abraham. He chose to bless Abraham, and he chose to bless Abraham's seed or offspring, and he chose to bless Abraham's descendants, Israel. And this was a promise, an eternal promise, as the text states, nothing would change it, not even the law of Moses, because if the law of Moses had to be obeyed to get the promise, then it is no longer a promise. It's like giving a Christmas present. I promised to give my wife a Christmas present. But then, 2 days before Christmas, I say, listen, you can have this present that I promised you if you do certain things. Then when she does that certain thing and I actually give it to her, then the reason why she got it was because she did something and my promise would be null and void. And I wouldn't be a very good husband because I would have changed my mind. A promise is a promise in the eyes of God. And the law of Moses, which is temporary, was temporary, and is now laid aside, as Paul said, does not nullify anything in the Abrahamic covenant. So to quickly recap, the Abrahamic covenant was directed to Abraham, to Jesus, and to Israel. In this section, Paul speaks of the two recipients, Abraham and Jesus, because he's speaking about being justified through faith in Jesus and being made righteous through faith in Jesus. He is not speaking about any of the promises directed to Israel concerning land, greatness of nation, and numerous amount of Israelis. He does that in Romans 9 through 11. Replacement theology does not see that there is a third recipient to the Abrahamic covenant. They just see Abraham and Jesus. And that's why they do not believe that Israel has any more prophetic or historic significance in the eyes of God. And that's why they go back into the Old Testament and reinterpret everything, anything and everything that was spoken to Israel, they believe now applies to the church. I strongly disagree. I do not believe this passage is proving anything that replacement theology teaches. There is one last thing I should say about the word seed, singular in this passage, and the Hebrew word zera, which seed is translated from. Like our English word seed or offspring, the Hebrew word zera can be used in a singular form or a plural form. And this is where the confusion lies, because as I said, the King James translates the word zera into English as seed all the way through, and therefore many Christians have believed seed to be singular, while the NIV translates Zira as offspring singular or descendants plural. There's a major difference there between the King James and the NIV. The problem arises in how should one translate Zira into English? Should they translate it as a singular word or a plural word? The King James translators lived in a day and age when the majority viewpoint was replacement theology. They had a very low view of Israel. Therefore, their theology would have determined how to translate Zira. They, for the most part, would not have translated Zira as descendants plural, which would have to mean Israel. They couldn't do that because they didn't believe Israel meant anything to God anymore. Well, that's a tricky thing. There's another reason how and why we should translate Zira into English as we do. It's the context. I believe the NIV translators have taken the context of the Hebrew word Zira in mind when they did the translating. How should the context determine how we translate this word? Should we translate it as a singular word or as a plural? And therefore, they do both in the Genesis account. But it is very interesting that the King James translators don't use the word descendants, and it could well be based on their theology. Again, for more information, visit my Galatians commentary, stevesweetman.com.